Speaking of liberty, the National Broadcasting Company presents another in a special series of programs under the auspices of the Council for Democracy. There was free talk in the old New England town hall and around the Cracker Barrel and the Crossroads store. And there's free talk by free men every week at this time on the air, led by our host, Rex Stout. Many of you already know Rex Stout as the author of Baffling Mystery Stories and as the distinguished brain parent of the equally distinguished Nero Wolfe, corpulent criminologist extraordinary. On this program, you will get to know him even better as an outspoken champion of our American democracy. Mr. Stout.
Good evening, friends of liberty. Well, another Japanese airplane has dropped another bomb on another American gunboat in the Yangtze River, and another Japanese foreign minister has hissed another apology. So sorry. I don't know. To paraphrase old Per Hansa, I don't know what Japan expects to accomplish by such management. If anyone does know, it should be our guest on this program this afternoon. Ernest Hauser first went to the Orient as a 20-year-old boy. He spent many years east of Suez as a roving correspondent and observer of men and events. He's been to Japan, Malaya, India, Indochina, China, and back to Japan. He's written books, Shanghai, City for Sale, An Honorable Enemy, his recent book about the Empire of the Rising Sun. When it comes to Japan, he knows the answers, if anyone does. Mr. Hauser, for heaven's sake, tell us, what do the pesky Japanese want?
Don't embarrass me, Mr. Stout, because I don't know the answers. There are far too many, and no man could know them all.
Well, tell us the ones you do know.
The most obvious thing the Japanese want is control of East Asia. We hear a lot of talk about the new order in Greater East Asia, which Japan has set out to construct. The idea, according to the Japanese, is an Asiatic Monroe Doctrine, Asia for the Asiatics. In reality, it's Asia for the Japanese.
Well, have they always thought Asia belonged to them, or is it a fairly new idea?
I think it is. When Japan invaded Manchuria 10 years ago, they told us they were have-nots. They needed more land, more raw materials, more markets. Then they marched into China and told us they had to eradicate communism. Now they are going beyond China and they tell us all they want is to bring peace and order to the billion people who inhabit the countries of South and East Asia.
A billion people? Your figures must be influenced by your recent trip to Washington.
I wish they were, Mr. Stout. But the new order under Japanese control is meant to comprise eventually all of China, French Indochina, Malaya, the Dutch East Indies and Thailand, British India, and probably the Philippines. That's a billion people, one half of all mankind.
But how can a small country with a population of 72 million even conceive such a scheme? It sounds like an acute case of megalomania.
That's precisely what it is, Mr. Stout. Megalomania is often the result of an inferiority complex. And the Japanese have a decided feeling of inferiority. For years, they had felt that the white man enjoyed all the privileges and advantages, and they themselves were playing second fiddle. Then Hitler came along and told the world that Anglo-Saxon superiority was a thing of the past. From now on, the world was going to be multi-central.
Multi-central?
Yes, at least that's what Hitler says he wants. Nazi Germany is to control Europe. Italy gets control of the Mediterranean. America can have the Western Hemisphere. Britain gets nothing. And Japan, well, there you are. Japan gets Greater East Asia.
Well, how is Japan to get control of a billion people? By military conquest?
The Japanese are supreme opportunists. They think they can get what they want gradually, step by step, using the same technique as the Nazis. More than that, they time their moves cleverly in relation to the German timetable of war, picking up what they can whenever they think the rest of the world is too busy to stop them.
Well, what if we decide we aren't too busy? Just what is their attitude toward us?
Well, up to this past week, when we started to put the screws on them, they were always complaining that we misunderstood them. You see, they feel that they know a lot more about us than we know about them. But one of the things they don't understand about us is our devotion to freedom of thought and freedom of speech, democracy, in other words. And I'm afraid they never will understand it.
Never is a big word, Mr. Hauser. Wasn't liberalism a strong force in Japan before the present Army-Navy combine rose to power?
Perhaps, It looked that way, Mr. Stout. When Japan westernized herself, she imported liberalism along with other Western institutions, such as banks and automobiles. But to me, this whole liberal veneer was just superimposed. Underneath, Japan was totalitarian. In fact, Japan is the oldest totalitarian system on Earth. Japanese society has been one totalitarian system for the last 3,000 years and still operates in the same way. All the new Western civilization is so much veneer, Mr. Stout. Underneath, the Japanese has not changed. Whatever their overlords decide is right, Mr. and Mrs. Japanese citizen accept with resignation.
Exactly who are these overlords?
There's Emperor Hirohito, of course. The real masters of Japan are outside the imperial palace. Men, or groups of men, who enjoy the emperor's confidence. Today, the generals of the army and the admirals of the navy. Between them, they hold a complete monopoly of power.
Well, you were talking about the common man in Japan, Mr. Hauser. What about his attitude toward the war in China?
He's pretty much disgusted. He's fed up. He doesn't see why he has to hate China today and Britain tomorrow and now the United States. All he wants is his bowl of rice.
What does a Japanese do when he's disgusted with the way things are going? I know he can't vote for a change as we can. What's he going to do, rebel?
Mr. Stout, don't get me wrong. Rebel, not the Japanese. For thousands of years, they have faced floods and famines and typhoons and fires and earthquakes. I'd say that they regard this national emergency just as another link in the chain of catastrophes. No, the Japanese will not revolt.
Under no circumstances, Mr. Hauser?
Perhaps in one case, Mr. Stout. In the case of military defeat.
Well, that may be on the program. With the United States, the British Empire, and the Dutch East Indies threatening a squeeze play, is that going to teach the Japanese overlords a lesson? Do you think they'd go on with their aggressive acts in Asia if they knew that it would bring them into a military conflict with this country?
That is too difficult, Mr. Stout. I'm an observer, not a prophet. But I go this far. In my opinion, the Japanese leaders are determined to continue their process of expansion north and south, come what may. They hope sincerely that it will not bring them into war with the United States. If it does, they feel they'll be able to defend themselves. They plan to keep on acquiring strategic bases and fight it out in Oriental waters under the protection of the Air Force. But as I say, both the generals and the admirals still think they can avoid war.
I thought the Japanese generals and admirals weren't agreed on anything. Are they agreed on that?
The main difference is this. They want to expand in different directions, Mr. Stout. The army looks north toward Manchuria, Mongolia, North China, and Russia. The navy, with its natural interest in oil, looks south toward the Dutch East Indies. But in both directions, there's fear. Fear of Russia in the north, fear of Britain and America in the south. The British have recently built up their strength in the neighborhood of Singapore and the Indies. Their position is formidable, much stronger than it was a year ago.
Well, then it looks like the North. Russia has all she can do with Germany.
Oh, yes, to be sure. But the Russian Far Eastern Army is not involved. The Soviets have powerful forces in Siberia, well-trained, well-armed, and independent of supplies from Western Russia. It would be possible for them to fight even if there were a collapse on Russia's European front. I've traveled along the Amur River front, where two of the world's finest armies face each other across a mile of water. Besides, there's this. Japan's great cities and industrial centers are arranged in a neat semicircle around Vladivostok, where Russia keeps her bombers. The distance is 600 to 700 miles. Japanese cities are literally made of wood and paper. The idea of bombing, of a whale of a bombing raid, gives even the most jingoistic Japanese the creeps.
I'm glad something does. What about the Chinese incident, as they call it?
I think if the Japanese generals could get out without loss of face, they would do it at once. That war goes on, draining Japan of more and more of her resources, and still they seem to be no nearer winning. The Chinese resistance has been wonderful.
How long can they keep it up? The Japanese, I mean.
That's difficult to answer. Japan is a poor country. She depends on outside supplies for her very existence, war or peace.
But could our trade restrictions force her to sue for terms, face or no face?
Not for some time, I believe. I am no economist, Mr. Stout, but I think I can say that I have seen as much as any foreigner of the Japanese industrial organization. I have talked with members of the Japanese cabinet and with the industrialists of Tokyo and Osaka. I have been through factories which are considered military secrets, but I have not, nor has anyone that I know of, peered into the oil tanks to see how much is left.
Well, put it another way, do you think there's any chance the Japanese economy will actually collapse?
As to that, no. Of course, the standard of living keeps falling and falling. Apparently, it can always go lower. The Japanese themselves proudly call their living standard elastic. Goods and materials keep on being used up, but apparently there's always something left. Remember, they've been piling up reserves for almost 10 years.
And also piling up a lot of ill will. Mr. Hauser, as an observer of both China and Japan, why do you think that we in America have always been so much more sympathetic with the Chinese?
I think the reason is quite a deep one, Mr. Stout. It is more than just sympathy with the underdog. You see, the Chinese, even during the empires of the Mongols and the Manchus, were always an essentially democratic people. The emperors collected the taxes and otherwise left the people to themselves. The people in the little shops and stores and in the village square ran their own government. So the Chinese are democratic today. Even while they fight under a strong central leadership, the Chinese spirit is individualistic and democratic. That is why there's always been such spontaneous sympathy between the Chinese and ourselves.
And the Japanese, as you say, are totalitarian. But even so, they're going to live until they die. Live how? What are they looking forward to?
I'd say this, Mr. Stout. The Japanese people are resigned to many lean years ahead. Most of them actually believe that it is the outside world, not their own militarists, that have brought them face to face with this so-called emergency. In accordance with the 1,000-year-old military code of their nation, they want to see it through rather than give in. Even the former liberals, the professors and merchants and industrialists, are no longer a force for peace and reason. They are absorbed by preparations for expansion. From what I've seen and heard in Japan, I'd say that the Japanese people today represent a solid front. They are back of the government's all-out effort, and they are willing to stick it through.
But do they realize it won't do them any good unless the Germans also stick it through? After all, Japan's fighting the world as part of the Axis.
So she is, Mr. Stout. Japan is an Axis member and, as such, takes orders from Hitler. Her actions are part of a worldwide plot directed against the democracies. It's possible, of course, that Japan may not always heed Mr. Hitler's commands, especially when it's not to her advantage. There's definite fear already that lest the fate of Italy be the fate of Japan also. The victorious Hitler might not be willing to divide the spoils with his Japanese allies.
So you don't believe, Mr. Hauser, that uncompromising American action now might make the Japanese generals and admirals think again?
It's not easy to predict what comes next, but there are no signs of weakening so far. Ultimately, the Battle of the Pacific will be decided in Europe. We are all concerned with the world that will emerge from this present turmoil. And seen from this angle, America's present stand in the Orient is a decisive factor for a peaceful Pacific in the post-war world. A democratic victory may yet make the Japanese useful and peaceful members of the family of nations.
Thank you, Mr. Hauser. Ladies and gentlemen, our guest today is Ernest Hauser, correspondent, traveler in the Far East, author of Shanghai City for Sale, and Honorable Enemy, his book on Japan. This is Rex Stout saying goodbye until next week.
You've just heard the 16th of a special series of programs entitled Speaking of Liberty, brought to you each week by the National Broadcasting Company in cooperation with the Council for Democracy, a national organization dedicated to the propagation of an American faith in democracy. Next week, Rex Stout will bring Douglas Miller to the microphone. A copy of the script of this broadcast will be mailed free to anyone requesting it. Please address your letter or card to the Council for Democracy, 285 Madison Avenue, New York City. This is the National Broadcasting Company.